I'm Jay Pierce, sitting in for David Inge. And in this hour of the program, we will shift the focus from politics and elections to conflict resolution. And perhaps that's not so far askew from the political and campaign scene. There are some conflicts, of course, that arise. But we'll be talking in particular today about what conflict resolution is, some of the principles of it, and how it applies to not only or some of the same dynamics might apply not only to a more localized level or a personal level, but also to a national or global level. And the guest is Bill Salzman, who is a mediation consultant and currently interim minister with the Faith Presbyterian Church in Monmouth, Illinois. And you may know Bill as a fill-in host on Keeping the Faith on Sunday evenings at 5 o'clock from time to time when Steve Shoemaker has a weekend off. And Bill will be giving the Friday Forum lecture at the University YMCA today at noon, so he'll be scooting out right at the end of the hour. And if you want to stop by and catch that, that'll be at noon at the University YMCA. But we're happy that he came in an hour early to spend the hour with us. And if you'd like to join the conversation at any point, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Or toll-free anywhere you can hear us. And if you're listening on the Internet anywhere in the United States, this number is good. It's 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. And, Bill, welcome to that side of the microphone. You've been on this side a couple of times.
Thank you, Jay.
Thank you for filling in for Steve when you have to.
Thank you.
But thanks for coming in this morning. I'm
glad to be here.
Well, let's talk, I guess, first about this concept of conflict resolution. How do we want to define it for purposes of our discussion this morning?
Well, maybe we should start by talking about what conflict is. Mm-hmm. It's been defined as wherever incompatible activities occur. That was the definition given by Morton Deutsch, who is a social psychologist at Columbia University in New York City. About 30 years ago, he was a pioneer in conflict research, and he defined conflict as what happens whenever incompatible activities occur. He was trying to be as general as possible in that definition, but he could have been more specific. And it's really wherever incompatible activities occur in among persons or groups that have some relationship or connection with one another. If you can have incompatible activities, such as you can decide to mow your lawn at 7 o'clock in the morning while your neighbor is trying to sleep. Those are incompatible activities, but it only becomes a conflict if your mowing bothers your neighbor's sleeping. If your neighbor doesn't care that you mow the lawn, then it's not really a conflict. There must be some kind of a connection or relationship between the parties. So it's conflict. You might define conflict as incompatible activities that occur among persons or groups who have some contact or relationship with one another, who have something in common.
Mm-hmm. Now, this goes back as long as there have been any kinds of relationships. Probably.
Yes, yes. Conflict. Conflict has always existed and will always exist. And one assumption is that conflict is bad. What mediators like to say is that conflict is simply there. It's like the weather. It's neither good nor bad, mm-hmm. Depending on the situation. It is essentially a neutral. It's a fact of life. What makes it bad or good is usually how it's resolved, if it does get resolved. Conflict can be good, just the way rain can be good in a drought, but not good in a flood time. Conflict can be good because it introduces the impetus for change in a system. Mm-hmm. If everything is peaceful and harmonious, everybody's getting along, there's no change in an institution or in people's lives, and that's good. But sometimes there is a need for change. Things have to happen, or things come up. For example, your car breaks down, and you suddenly have to spend money that you maybe don't have on it, or somebody might want to raise. Something happens that introduces change into a harmonious system, and when that change occurs, it is often perceived as conflict among the persons who are affected by the change, as mm-hmm. people have different ideas about how to handle the problem. Mm-hmm. Conflict can be good in the sense that it introduces the impetus for change into a system which may become stagnant and in need of shaking up.
So in your role as a mediation consultant or mediator, your role is to take the information from both sides and do what?
What is it that you do? No, in mediation, the mediator is a neutral mm-hmm. third party who sits together with the parties in a conflict mm-hmm. and helps them to discover what their common interests are. The mediator does not do anything in particular with the information. What he or she does is helps the parties. The mediator clears away obstacles to communication between the parties, basically, and helps them to work through the issues that exist between them, to try to achieve some kind of a resolution that both can live with, an agreement.
Clearing the obstacles.
Yes.
And creating a dialogue in which each side clearly communicates with the other then. So I guess part of your role then would be to be able to recognize the obstacles, as you say, phrases or manners of speaking or certain manners of communicating that may not be effectively getting the point across, that may be interference, in other words.
Well, there are mediators have a number of functions. They perform a number of functions when the parties agree to have their conflict mediated.
Mm-hmm.
I might just say that a necessary prelude to mediation is that the parties must agree that they want to work this out. They have got to agree voluntarily that they need help, that they want to work it out. Mm-hmm. Then they call in the mediator, whose most important characteristic is that she or he is a neutral, is seen as neither as unpartisan, is not has having no stake in the outcome, and does not take the side of either party. Of the two most useful skills that a mediator has is simply the ability to listen. It's sometimes called active listening. It's what counselors do. It's mm-hmm. what preachers and priests should be trained to do. Psychologists have to learn this skill of detaching oneself from the situation to be able to look at it somewhat objectively and listen to beyond the words to truly what what the different sides are saying. That's one skill in mediation. Another one is the ability to reframe what is being said in such a way that it accurately communicates or helps the parties to accurately communicate with one another what they really want to say, what they really mean. But basically, the mediators have a number of functions that they fulfill. They set a framework or an atmosphere in that encourages cooperation. They help to define the issues, to decide, help the parties to decide what the conflict is about. Often, the issue is not the issue. In other words, what is presented as the problem is not really the problem. There's often something more underlying. The mediator helps the parties to define what the real issue is. They help narrow the issues where there's where they seem to be too broad or there's too many tangents. Mediator will help to define things more carefully and make it a manageable outcome. Mm-hmm. They control the discussion of the issues, usually by setting ground rules and by functioning as a moderator, in effect, so that each side gets equal chance to explain their point of view, and the mediator acts as a kind of a referee or a cop in that sense. They make sure that the bargaining is based on people's interests, and that's something I'd like to talk about. Mm-hmm. And they promote reality. There's a number of things that the mediator helps the parties to do to clear away obstacles to communication
right.
with each other.
Yeah. In other words, when you have a very vested interest, obviously, if I have a problem with something you're doing, I have a vested interest in my personal standing in this.
Exactly.
And I don't see your side of it. So what you're saying is that we're trying to convince each side the other side's got a point, and then try to get past that initial feeling that I have of, you know, I've got to be right, you are wrong, to maybe open up my eyes or my ears to a discussion here.
Yeah, that's you're getting okay. close to my main thesis.
Yeah,
and that is that when conflict occurs, the parties to the conflict quickly start to see themselves as adversaries.
Mm-hmm.
And they, as just what you said, I think only about my interests or the position I want. You think only about what you want. Even though we have this relationship with one another, that means that in order for this to get settled, we each have to get what we need out of the situation. What has to happen I know it's a trite term, but there has to occur a paradigm shift in our apprehension of what's going on, from adversaries who are in a contest with one another over whatever it might be, who are promoting only their own interests,
mm-hmm.
to seeing themselves as partners in a mutual problem. We are here to try to solve a problem that we both share. How are we going to do that? And in order to become to function as partners, we have to hear what what the concerns that each of us has is.
Mm-hmm.
I have to understand your situation. You have to understand mine. And then when the problem can be laid out like that in all of its richness, then we can try to generate alternatives, different ways of thinking about it and maybe solving it than we had thought of before. There's probably one of the most helpful books on this is a book by Roger Fisher, and I I think his name is William Urey, and they wrote this little paperback. It's called Getting to Yes, and there's a subtitle to that, Getting to Yes. You can pick it up in any bookstore. And in that little book, they say that some mediators have this trick of when they get the parties in the room, they don't sit them on opposite sides of the table, like you see, you'll see a negotiation in the news on television, where the labor's on one side of the table and management is on the other. The Israelis are on one side of the table and the Palestinians are on the other, and they're glaring at one another. what mediators have this trick of putting both parties on the same side of the table, facing a blackboard, very much like a football team in the locker room at halftime having a chalk talk, where the problem may be written on the blackboard, and both parties are sitting on the same side of the table, side by side, looking at the problem. It conveys in a symbolic way the idea that we have this problem that's written down, and we are here to solve this together.
Bring up an interesting point. Setting one world leader over here and the other over here, two different sides of the issue at least, that's the image that you get.
Yes.
The same thing is probably true when we see, as you mentioned, labor and management, when you see couples, for instance.
Yes.
Okay, over in this chair. It's the old the image of in this corner and in this corner. And it occurs to me that's the same thing that we tend to do when we have political debates, as you have two separate podiums, as if this candidate is way over here on this side of everything and this one's the opponent. We call them the opponent. It's not two people running for the same office. They're opponents.
Yes.
In the race. Is that something, I mean, is that, you know, we do that. Why do we do that?
Well, because we have a society which and a political system which is set up as a contest, where there's going to be a winner and a loser, and it's we've got a polarized, politicized political system, so that the Republicans and Democrats are considered to be adversaries somehow, rather than as partners. And the Constitution sets up a procedure where the Congress can passes the laws, but the president has to sign them. And when they're of different parties, they do have to find a way to work it out. They do have to eventually come together, which is helpful. But the whole beginning notion that we are adversaries who are trying to win rather than as partners who are trying to solve a common problem tends to get in the way. But I don't know why we do it, but we set things up like a contest, and it's not helpful for good government.
We do that in so much of our lives, in work situations. It always seems it seems to come down to, okay, I want to go in and ask for a raise. The boss is going to say no. There's got to be this little. It's like buying a car. So many different situations on this level put us into these adversarial situations. You're going to want more money for the car than I'm going to want to pay, so we become adversaries in this. I'm going to ask for a bigger raise than you're going to want to pay. It's the job of the boss, in the name of the company, to pay as little for as much work as possible. It's the job of the employee to go in and get as much money for
as little work
as possible, perhaps. Why do we set these
It's unfortunate because just to take your example of the car salesman. Actually, the situation is that both the customer and the salesman want to sell the car. In other words, the customer wants to buy it. That's why he or she is there, and that is why the salesman wants to sell it. That's a common. They have a common goal.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we work it out? And often they do now. There's a package. You get so much for your trade-in. You the salesman might throw in an extra package or give you a low finance rate or something to sweeten the deal. You come. It's not just you pay the price that's asked. There's usually
a negotiation.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, a customer buying a car and a salesman selling the car are in fact partners in the same enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
If only they could see it.
It's a new way to look at it. And I don't mean honestly to single out car dealers.
Right.
That just happens to be one of the items that in particular we seem to have this negotiation on. We don't do that in others. You don't walk in to buy a washing machine and start negotiations with the person at, the salesperson the same way you do when you buy a car.
When you buy a car. So, and now some car companies are
starting to go to it.
Yeah. But there's and in labor management talks, you want it's actually you can reframe the problem. It's not that that the management wants to pay as little and get as much work, and the employee wants to get as much money and as little work as possible. The employee wants the job. He wants to work there, and the employer wants that person to work there.
Mm-hmm.
That's they need each other. Now, how can we work out a situation in which that makes it possible for us to work together? That that should be the way the problem is looked at.
And I would suspect it's becoming more that way than the old
stereotype.
I brought up the stereotype to make a point
so
that we'd have
Dagwood
a point of discussion.
Dagwood in the comic strip, always going in the ask for a raise.
Exactly. We're at about the midpoint of the program, and we'll get to the telephone in just a moment because we have a caller on line one. But I want to reintroduce our guest, Bill Sausman, who is a mediation consultant and interim minister with Faith Presbyterian Church in Monmouth, Illinois, right now. And he'll be giving the Friday Forum Lecture at the University YMCA at noon today, and we're glad that he's here talking about conflict resolution in this hour. And let's go to the telephone on line one. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Very interesting conversation, and I agree with a lot of the points that have been raised. I just wanted to raise one issue. I almost swerved off the road hearing the question raised, why is politics confrontational? Politics is a competition. There's no desire to reach a mutual goal. That's the difference between lawmaking and having elections. In fact, the American judicial process is not a search for the truth. Now, you can ask why the founding fathers assumed there was an inherent conflict, and I think it probably has a lot to do with the fact that the state is assumed to be inherently in opposition to the individual, and you have to protect one from the other. But that's a major part of the American system, and truly, it is very dysfunctional in terms of governing, but it's not necessarily dysfunctional in terms of elections or in terms of justice. Just thought I'd raise that point.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you very much for doing so. And that's an excellent point. I didn't mean swerve off the road. Be careful if you're calling and or using a car phone or listening in the car, apparently, even on that. But that's a good point. I mean, not everything's going to be a situation where we can sit down and come to a mutual agreement and everybody's very happy and we go away very peaceful. Life, by the very nature of things, I would imagine that if we didn't have some kind of a conflict, we wouldn't be as passionate as we are. And maybe it's that passion that gets us into a lot of the conflict as well. When I'm very passionate about something and somebody else is not as passionate as I am about it, or is passionate about it in a different way, or about something that's diametrically opposed to what I'm passionate about, that's when you really get into some good conflict. But as you say, that can be good because it can bring out different ideas, different thoughts.
Yeah, it's the competition is not necessarily bad in the sense that it presents in a forceful way. It presents ideas, usually new ideas, in a particularly forceful way, and allows people to consider those ideas. But at some point, a decision has to be made about how we're going to run things. And that can best, and there are different ideas about how that can happen. And there are different interests that are involved. There are real needs that are behind a lot of the positions that are taken. Mm-hmm. And we need to find a way so that we can try to meet the needs of everybody involved. I do want to emphasize that not everything can be worked out in negotiation or mediation. Not every conflict is going to be resolved in a harmonious way. There are courts that exist to impose solutions where the parties themselves are unable to come to an agreement. I'm not making the point that courts are or other ways to enforce a solution are always wrong. That the competitive system is always inadequate. It is wrong, but it is used too often and often too quickly, without the opportunity to be given to explore the issues in a more considered way.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another phone call on line one. This call is from Urbana. Hi, you're on the air. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Well, my question actually is a sort of a reworking of some of the things you just talked about. I'm not sure because you just addressed some of it. Sometimes conflict is between people, and there are layers. Like, it's a psychological thing. Let's say if people are in conflict about money, particularly, or property, if they are either family or if they perhaps had once been married or something. And so some of the conflict may be named having to do with property, but the real issues also have to do with relationship issues or hurt. And so they go into a situation where they're seeking mediation about property, but the psychological issues are perhaps more important, at least maybe to one of the parties, or I don't know, to different degrees. When the mediator faces an issue like that, is the job only to stay on the level of the stated conflict about property, or seeing the psychological resolution, and then would it be the mediator's responsibility to see that if the psychological, say, a hurt thing is addressed, then that both parties still get a fair shake as far as property goes? Mm-hmm. Is that a clear?
I think I know and understand what you're getting at, and you're exactly correct that the underlying nature of the relationship, what you're calling the psychological factors, are very important in factors in a conflict, and they need to be recognized just as much as the more mundane or more tangible issues such as finances or the property division or the parenting arrangements for children in a divorce case. That needs to be surfaced as well. Professor Deutsch, who I mentioned before, said that in virtually all conflict is about some combination of five factors. The first is one issue, type of issue, is conflict over resources. That is, who's going to get what. A second one is over preferences, what one party prefers over what the other party prefers. These are often in matters of taste. The third is values. What are the underlying values that each party brings to the table? The fourth is beliefs, the perception of reality. What does each party think is happening here? And the fifth issue that is often in according to Professor Deutsch, in conflict is the nature of the relationship between the parties. Each of those things has got to be examined to the extent that they're present. In the example that you just gave, you might have a surface issue of resources. What are the family's finances going to be, or who's going to support what with what income? But underlying that is the nature of the relationship between the parties, and unless that can be surfaced and discussed, and neutralized in some way, then you're not going to be able to resolve the issue of the resources, which is ostensibly what brought you together. So you in mediation, you have to address the issues at all levels, not simply on the basis of the material or the tangible concern.
Okay, does that address your question?
I guess so. The final part was in mediation, then recognizing, let's say that you do finally address the relationship, and the one the hurt issue is kind of the immediate thing that gets addressed, then would the mediator still be sure that the resource issue is resolved fairly?
Oh, yes, you're done. Before the mediation is ended, you would first want to work on the problem with the relationship. You don't want to necessarily bring peace and harmony, but at least you need to surface the fact that this is interfering with a decision about the resources question. And that needs to be surfaced. But then before you do eventually get around to solving the problem or trying to resolve the problem that brought you there in the first place, the financial concerns. Yeah, you would, but you need to deal with one first, because if the nature of the relationship is interfering with your discussion with one another, then you're not going to be able to reach a decision about the resource question that brought you there, because you get all this interference. I might just say one thing about the nature of conflict. What happens very often is that it starts with a concern about something tangible or fairly tangible, and that is often the way it's presented. But very often, as hostility increases, the conflict very quickly becomes personalized, so that the issue then ceases to be simply to get what you want or what you need, but also to beat the other one. And one of the first steps that has to occur in any resolution of a conflict is what Fisher and Urey call separating the people from the problem. In other words, you need to diffuse the interpersonal conflict between the parties so that does not interfere any longer with getting at the heart of the problem. You've got to help the parties to overcome the desire to personalize the issues, and take it out on one another.
All right, thank you very much for the call. And I guess this, let me mention again that Bill Salzman is the guest, and he is a mediation consultant, and we're talking about conflict resolution. And if you'd like to join the conversation, we still have 10 minutes or so for your phone calls at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. And I'm Jay Pierce, sitting in for David Inge today on Focus 580 here on WILL. Bill, you bring up a good point, and thanks to that caller for bringing this up, because this seems like it's pitting in a lot of cases. You have to get through the emotional aspect before you can get to the logical aspect of a conflict. Because a lot of this, if you get down and pare it right down to the main point, the salient point, maybe there's a very logical division of property, division of assets, division of the tangible, things, a determination of ownership. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is that was the source of the conflict may have a very logical resolution. But we've built up from it like a mushroom cloud because we are very emotional people. We're not logical like Dr. Spock in Star Trek.
Right.
Who even he had some signs of, you know, having emotion. But the point is that we're humans. And we have a world of experience, a world of history that we bring to it. We may have some religious beliefs that we bring to it. Just a whole host of things flying around us that all make us what we are and come to the table. How do you sit down? How do you wade through that? And this not only, you know, it applies on a personal level, but expanded globally. When you see a president sitting down, and I don't think anybody really honestly believes that the president mediates between two world leaders and will come out of the Camp David talks amongst the three of them with this big resolution, because when you get to the global level, not only are you bringing the immediate conflict of whose land is this, but you're going back, as I mentioned, into the personalities of the two world leaders involved, the histories of their nations, maybe some religious conflicts that have happened, the desires, and the whole emotional makeup of the populations they represent.
Yes, and what you need to do on a global level or an international level, it is very complex. But what you need to do is bring all of these emotional issues to the surface. They need to be acknowledged as being there, but at some point they need to be set aside. As Fisher and Urey say, you need to separate the people from the problem. If you're talking about a division of assets or even who has sovereignty over East Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. It's not the personalities of the persons who are negotiating are not really the issue. Then it needs to be acknowledged that they're complicating the issue. You need to acknowledge it, bring it on the surface so that it can be acknowledged, but then set aside so that you can deal with what the real interests are. And one of the main tasks in any negotiation is to define what people's real interests are, not their positions, not the opening position that they say they want, mm-hmm. but what do they really need? Because behind every position that someone presents, there are real needs that people have that lead them to take the positions that they do. What we need to do is get rid of the personality, at least acknowledge the personality conflicts exist, the posturing, mm-hmm. and then get to a each side can define and express what its needs are, and then you generate different options that will attempt to meet the needs of both sides.
Let's take another call on line one from Champaign. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, where do mediators get training, and what's the market for mediators like?
Seems to be growing.
Well, as long as there's been conflict, there's been need for mediation. But mediator. I received training from a mediation training institute in Minnesota, at the Erickson Mediation Institute, and there are a number of mediation training centers, mostly that center around divorce or family mediation. If you were interested, you could contact the family, the Academy of Family Mediators in Lexington, Massachusetts, or there's a group called SPIDR, S-P-I-D-R, You can look that up on the internet. There's any number of groups that have training for what's known as alternative dispute resolution. And some universities may offer courses in mediation training. There is a demand, particularly in jurisdictions where mediation is required at some point by the courts, where there are some states now that are like Minnesota, for example, California, I believe, that are requiring parties to at least attempt mediation before they're allowed to bring a suit to court. And particularly that's true in divorce cases, where in Minnesota, I believe it's the case that a couple who wants to divorce must at least attempt to have their divorce mediated before they're allowed to bring it into the court, which means that in Minnesota, mediation is in fact a growth industry. Illinois does not have requirements like that, so there's fewer opportunities for mediation, but it's growing all the time. In Champaign County, if there's in a divorce cases, if there's a dispute over parenting arrangements of the children between the parties, then they do have to have the parenting arrangement portion at least attempt at mediation before they are allowed to come to court. I don't know if that answers your questions.
Sure.
Try www.mediators.org,
okay.
And that'll give you the name of some mediation resources.
Are there accrediting organizations, or is there
increasingly? And some states are now moving to license mediators. They're licensed the way they might license social workers, and I'm not sure of what the situation is in Illinois right now. I think Indiana and Florida may have require some kind of a licensing or certification of mediators, but I'm not certain about that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much for the call. Well, we have just a couple of minutes left, Bill. The time has flown.
Yes.
But it's certainly a thing. And to answer the question about demand, perhaps we'll just we'll get into that for the last moment that we have here. Obviously, there has been mediation of some sort back to the first conflict, whether it became a war, and that's the way they mediated it. But it seems like more and more of late, we try to be a more conscious society, a more enlightened society, and try to resolve things before they come to blows.
Yes.
And so it would, at least on the surface, seem to me that there is more of a demand for persons like yourself who will sit a couple of people down and instead of a fisticuff or a big court battle, try to, keep the thing from escalating.
And where they can work it out themselves rather than have a third party like a court impose something on them. This, if you can work it out yourself, you are more likely to have your needs met. You know, there are basically four different possible responses to conflict. There's force. There's avoidance. You can just break off a relationship, and that ends it. You can conciliate. One side can just give in. Like a mother may decide to buy the kid a candy bar in the checkout aisle of the supermarket rather than endure a tantrum. That's conciliation of that conflict. But the best way, the way that most satisfactory way to resolve conflict is through some form of collaboration. Mediation is a form of collaboration. It's where the parties sit down and they talk through their differences until they try to solve the common problem between them until they can reach a solution.
And hopefully that's what happens in our structure of government, except in the political races, because we have set that up. And I don't know how you would change at least the races, because, as you said, it is a competition. Once in office, we would hope that the House and Senate and
yes.
President, as they do, can reach.
Yeah, we're not going to change the system, at least not anytime soon. But at least you can hope that those people who do get elected might be able to bury the partisan hatchet long enough to start looking and try to solve the problems. We've got a problem with Medicare. We've got a problem with Social Security. There are any number of ways in which that can be resolved. But let's get the different ideas brought to the table and work on solving them as a problem, rather than looking at Medicare or Social Security as political issues that you can get the most mileage out of. So,
Bill, thank you very much. I know you have to scoot. You'll be speaking in the noon hour over at the University YMCA, and we appreciate you taking the hour ahead of that to come talk with us this morning.
It's been a pleasure, Jay. Thank you.